Trees and mountain were an impenetrable slab of black. "Jamie," I said more calmly, and wrapped a hand firmly round his forearm. "What is it, do you think? Wolves? A wolf, I mean." I hope there was only one of whatever was making that sound. He started at the touch, swung round to see me and shook his head hard, trying to shake off something. He began, voice hoarse with sleep, and then he simply put his arms around me and drew me against him. I thought it was a dream. I could feel him trembling a little and held him as hard as I could. A sinister Celtic word like banshee was fluttering round my head, whispering in my ear. Custon said that a banshee howled on the roof when someone in the house was about to die. Well, it wasn't on the bloody roof, at least, because there wasn't one. "Are your dreams usually that loud?" I asked, wincing at a fresh ululation. He hadn't been out of bed long. His skin was cool but not chilled.
"Aye, sometimes."
He gave a small, breathless laugh and let go of me. A thunder of small feet came down the hallway, and I hastily flung myself back into his arms as the door burst open and Jem rushed in, Fanny right behind him.
"Kanda, there's a wolf outside. It'll eat the biggies."
Fanny gasped and clapped a hand to her mouth, eyes round with horror, not at the thought of the piglet's imminent demise, but at the realization that Jamie was naked. I was shielding as much of him from view as I could with my nightgown, but there wasn't a great deal of nightgown, and there was a great deal of Jamie. "Go back to bed, sweetheart," I said, as calmly as possible. "If it's a wolf, Mr. Fraser will deal with it."
"Morantank, Sassanach," he whispered out of the corner of his mouth. "Thanks a lot. Jim, throw me my plaid, aye?"
Jim, to whom a naked grandfather was a routine sight, fetched the plaid from its hook by the door.
"Can I come and help kill the wolf?" he asked hopefully. "I could shoot it. I'm better than Da. He says so."
"It's no a wolf," Jamie said briefly, swathing his loins in faded tartan. "The two of you go and tell Mandy it's all right before she brings the roof down about her ears."
The howling had grown louder, and so had Mandy's in hysterical response. From the look on her face, Fanny was all set to join them. Bree appeared in the door, looking like the Archangel Michael, all flowing white robe and ferocious hair, with Roger's sword in her hand. Fanny let out a small whimper at the sight.
"What were you planning to do with that onion?" Jamie inquired, nodding at the sword as he prepared to pull his shirt over his head. "I don't think you can run a goose through."
Fanny looked goggle-eyed from Bree to Jamie, then sat down on the floor with a thump and buried her head in her knees. Jem was goggle-eyed too.
"A ghost?" he said blankly. "A ghost wolf?"
I glanced uneasily at the window. Jemmy was old enough to have heard of werewolves, and the word conjured up an unpleasantly vivid picture in my own mind as a particularly desolate and penetrating moan pierced the momentary silence.
"I told you it's no a wolf," Jamie said, sounding both cross and resigned. "It's a dog."
"Rollo!"
Jamie exclaimed, in tones of horror.
"He's come back?"
Fanny jerked her head up, wide-eyed. Bree made an involuntary noise, and just as involuntarily, I grabbed Jamie's arm again.
"Jesus Christ," he said, rather mildly under the circumstances, and detached my grip. "I doubt it."
But I'd felt the wiry hairs on his arms bristling at the thought, and my own skin rippled into goose flesh.
"Stay here," he said briefly,
and turned toward the door. Callously abandoning Bree to deal with the children's conniptions, I followed him. Neither of us had paused to light a candle, and the stairwell was dark and cold as an actual well. The howling was muffled here, though, which was a slight relief.
"You're sure it's a dog?" I said to Jamie's back.
"I am," he said.
His voice was firm, but I heard him swallow, and a thread of uneasiness tightened down my back. He turned left at the foot of the stair and went into the kitchen. I let out my breath as the stored warmth of the big room flowed over me. The smoured hearth glowed faintly,
showing the comfortably rounded, solid shapes of cauldron and kettle hanging in their places, the faint gleam of pewter on the sideboard. The door was bolted. Despite the snug feeling of the kitchen, my scalp stirred uneasily. The sound was louder now, rising and falling in a rhythm much at odds with my own breathing. I couldn't tell for sure, but I thought it was louder, closer than it had been. Jamie had thrust a faggot into the embers of the hearth. He pulled it out now and blew carefully on the ragged end of the torch until a small flame rose from the glowing wood. His frown relaxed as the fire took, and he smiled briefly at me.
"Dinna fashion, Ian," he said. "'Tis no but a dog, truly."
I smiled back, but there was still an uncertain note in his voice, and I quietly picked up the stone rolling pin as I followed him to the door. He lifted the heavy bar and set it down, then lifted the latch without hesitation and pulled the door open. The cold damp of a mountain night swept in, fluttering my nightdress and reminding me that I ought to have put on my cloak. There wasn't time for that, though, and I bravely followed Jamie out onto the back stoop. The noise was louder out here, but suddenly seemed less agitated. It settled into something like an owl's cry. I scanned the hillside that rose behind the house, but couldn't see anything in the faint flicker of the torch. Despite being so exposed, I felt steadier. Jamie might have his own doubts, but he didn't think this mysterious dog was dangerous, or he wouldn't be letting me stand here with him. He sighed deeply, put two fingers in his mouth, and gave a piercing whistle. The noise stopped.
"Well, come on then," he said,
raising his voice a little, and gave a second, softer whistle. The woods were silent, and nothing happened for the space of a minute or more. Then something moved. A blot detached itself from the tomato vines around the privy and came slowly toward us. I heard feet coming down the distant stairs and the muffled sound of voices, but all my attention was focused on the dog. For a dog it was. I caught a glimpse of golden eyes glowing in the dark, and then it was close enough to see the shambling, long-legged gait and the sinuous curve of backbone and tail. "A hound?" I said.
"It is."
Jamie handed me the torch, sank onto his haunches, and stretched out a hand. The dog, it was what they called a blue tick hound, with a heavy dappling of blue-black spots over most of its coat, seemed to sink a little as it came to him, head low.
"It's all right, Ian," he said to the dog,
his voice low and husky. "You know this dog?"
"I do,"
he said, and I thought there was a note of regret in his voice. He stroked her head, though, and she came up close, tail wagging tentatively.
"She's starving, poor thing," I said.
The hound's ribs were visible, even by torchlight, her belly drawn up like a purse string.
"Have we a bit of meat, Sathanach?"
"I'm sure we do."
The others were in the kitchen, but had stopped talking, hearing our voices outside. They'd be out here in a minute. "Jamie," I said, and laid a hand on his bare back. "Where did you see this dog before?" I felt him swallow.
"I left her howling on her master's grave," he said quietly. "Dinna mention it to the bairns, aye?"
The dog seemed visibly taken aback at sight of so many people flooding out onto the back porch and turned away as though to flee back into the bushes. But she couldn't bring herself to leave the smell of food and kept turning in circles with small apologetic wags of her long feathered tail. At length, Jamie succeeded in quelling the hubbub and making everyone go into the kitchen while he lured the hound close with small pieces of leftover cornbread soaked in bacon grease. I stayed, hovering behind him with the torch. The hound came willingly for the food, ducking her head submissively, and when Jamie reached tentatively to scratch her behind the ears, she let him, picking up the tempo of her wagging.
"There's a good lass,"
he murmured to her, and gave her another bit of bread. Despite her hunger, she took it delicately from his hand, not snapping.
"She's not afraid of you,"
I said quietly.
I didn't mean to ask him, never would ask him, but that didn't mean I didn't wonder.
No, he said just as softly. No, she's not. She only saw me bury him.
You're not bothered by her? Her coming here, I mean. Plainly he had been disturbed by the howling, who wouldn't have been? But I couldn't tell now. His face was calm in the flicker of the torchlight.
No, he said, and glanced over his shoulder to be sure the children were out of earshot. I was when I saw her, but...
His greasy hand paused, resting for a moment on the dog's rough coat.
I think it's maybe absolution that she should have come to me.
Inside, the dog ate ravenously, but with an odd delicacy, nibbling up the scraps of bread and meat with tiny darts of her head. It didn't seem quite right somehow, and I began to watch more closely. The children were entranced, taking turns to hold bits of food in their palms for her to take. But I saw Jamie frown slightly, watching.
There's somewhat amiss with her mouth, I think, he said after a moment. Shall we have a look?
Oh, let her finish eating, please, Mr. Fraser, Fanny said, looking up at him earnest. She's so hungry.
Aye, she is, he said, squatting down beside them.
He ran a hand gently down the dog's knobby backbone, and her tail moved briefly, but her whole attention was focused on the food.
Why is she starving, I wonder?
Why? I asked. I glanced at him, careful what I said. Perhaps she's lost her master.
Aye, but she's a hound. She can hunt for herself. And it's summer. There's food everywhere. Master or no, she shouldn't be in this case.
Curious, I got down on my knees and looked closely. He was right. She was gulping the small bites of food, simply swallowing with little or no mastication. That might be her personal habit, or perhaps any dog would do that with small bits of food like this. But... there was something wrong. Something not quite a wince, but... You're right, I said. Let her finish, and I'll have a look. The hound polished off the last of the scraps, sniffed hungrily for more, though by now her stomach was visibly distended, then lapped water, and after a glance at the assembled company, nosed Jamie's leg and lay down beside him.
By some harsher horn,
he said, running a light hand down her long back. Her tail wagged gently, and she let out a great sigh, seeming to melt into the floorboards.
Well, then, he said in the same soft tones, come and let me see your mouth, Munion.
The dog looked surprised, but didn't resist as he rolled her onto her side.
She is blue, isn't she?
Fanny crawled closer, fascinated, and put out a tentative hand, though she didn't quite touch the dog.
Aye, they call this kind a blue tick hound. They're the colour o' mattress ticking. Let her smell your fingers, lass, so she kens who you are. Then just move slow. But she seems a friendly bitch.
Fanny blinked at the word and glanced at Jamie. Have you never had a dog, Fanny? Bree asked, seeing this little byplay.
No, Fanny replied uncertainly. I mean, I remember a dog from when I was very little. I remember petting him.
Her hand touched the dog's back and the hound's tail stirred.
It was on the ship. I sat under the big sail when the weather was good and he'd come and sit with me and let me pet him.
Bree exchanged a quick glance with Roger, who was on the settle holding Amanda half asleep.
The ship? She said to Fanny, her voice light and casual.
You were on a ship? Before you came to Philadelphia?
Fanny nodded, only half paying attention. She was watching me as I ran a finger along the black inner lip, lifting it away from the dog's teeth. The gums were all right, so far as I could see by firelight. Not bleeding, maybe a little pale, maybe not. It was common to find parasites in dogs, and that could cause pale gums from internal blood loss. But I didn't know of any parasitic infections that occurred in the mouth. Jem had sat down on the floor with us and was scratching the dog behind the ears with a practiced hand.
Like this, Fanny, he said. Dogs like to have their ears scratched.
The dog sighed in bliss and relaxed a little, letting me open her mouth. The teeth were good, very clean.
Why do people say clean as a hound's tooth? I asked, feeling the angles of her jaw,
the temporomandibular joints, no apparent tenderness, and the lymph nodes in the neck, not lumpy. But there was some swelling on the side of the lower jaw, and she winced and whined at my touch.
Her teeth are clean. But do hounds really have cleaner teeth than other dogs?
Och, maybe. Jamie leaned forward to look in the dog's mouth. She's a young bitch, maybe nae more than a year or so. Hunting dogs that eat their prey usually have clean teeth, though, from the bones.
Really? I was only half listening. Turning the dog's head a little more toward the fire, I'd seen the shadow of something. Jamie, can you bring a candle or something closer here? I think she has something stuck between her teeth.
Were your parents with you, Fanny?
Roger's voice was quiet, barely pitched above the crackle of the fire.
On the ship.
Fanny's hand stopped for a moment, resting on the dog's head, but then resumed scratching more slowly.
I think so, she said, hesitant.
The candle flame wavered as Jamie glanced at Fanny, then steadied.
Yes, there it is.
It was a small chip of bone, wedged tightly between the dog's lower premolars. It was evidently sharp. The gum had been cut and was swollen and spongy-looking around the site of the injury. I pressed gently, and the dog whimpered and tried to pull her head away.
Jimmy, run to the surgery and fetch me the little first-aid box. You know the one.
Sure, Granny.
He hopped up and made off into the darkness of the front hall without a qualm.
Will she be all right, Mrs... Mrs. Fraser?
Fanny leaned forward anxiously, trying to see.
I think so,
I said, trying to wiggle the bone chip with my thumbnail. The dog didn't like it, but didn't snarl or offer to bite. She has a bit of bone stuck between her teeth, and it's made her mouth sore. But if it hasn't made an abscess under the tooth... You can let her go for a minute, Jamie. I can't get it out till Jem comes back with my forceps. Released, the dog leapt up, shook herself vigorously, and then shot off rushing down the hall after Jem. Fanny rose up on her knees, but before she could get up altogether, the dog came roaring back, paws thundering on the wooden floor. She let out an excited bark at seeing us, ran round the room in circles, and finally leapt on Fanny, knocking her sideways, then stood over her, panting happily and wagging.
Get off!
Fanny said, giggling as she squirmed out from under the dog.
You silly thing.
I smiled, and glancing at Jamie, saw him smiling too. Fanny laughed with the boys, but seldom otherwise.
Here, Granny.
Jem dropped the first aid box on my lap, then dropped to his knees and started boxing with the dog, feinting slaps to one side of her face and then the other. The hound panted happily and made little woofs, darting her head at Jem's hands.
She'll nip you, Jem, Jamie said, amused. She's quicker than you are.
She was, and she did, though not hard. Jem yelped, then giggled.
Silly thing,
he said.
Shall we call her silly?
No,
said Fanny, giggling too.
That's a silly name.
That poor dog will never get her mouth taken care of if the lot of you don't stop stirring her up, I said severely. For Brianna and Jamie were laughing too. Roger was smiling, but not laughing, not wanting to wake Mandy, now sound asleep on his shoulder. Bree calmed the incipient riot by going to the pie safe and extracting half of a large dried apple pie, which she distributed to everyone, including a small piece of crust to the dog, who wolfed it happily. All right. I swallowed the last flaky, cinnamon-scented bite of my own slice, dusted crumbs off my fingers, the dog promptly snuffled them up off the floor, and laid out my small splinter forceps, my smallest tenaculum, a square of thick gauze, and after a moment's thought, the bottle of honey water, the mildest antibacterial I had.
Let's go, then.
Once we'd got the dog immobilized, on her side, No easy matter. She writhed like an eel. But Jem flung himself on top of her back half, and Jamie pressed her down with one hand on her shoulder and one on her neck. It took no more than a couple of minutes to work the bone chip loose, with Fanny carefully holding the candle so as not to drip wax on me or the dog. There. I held it up in the forceps to general applause, then tossed it into the fire. Now, just a bit of clean-up. I pressed the gauze over the gum firmly. The dog whined a little, but didn't struggle. A small amount of blood from the lacerated gum and what might be a trace of pus, hard to tell by candlelight. But I brought the gauze to my nose and couldn't detect any scent of putrefaction. Meat scraps, apple pie and dog breath, but no noticeable smell of infection. Once the bone chip was out, interest in my activities waned, and the conversation turned back to dog names. Lulu, Sassafras, Ginny, Monstro, this from Bree, and I looked up and met her eye with a smile, visualizing the toothy whale from Disneyland as plainly as she did.
Is it?
Jamie didn't take part in the naming controversy, but he did, for the first time, stroke the dog's head gently. Did he already know what her name was, I wondered. I rinsed the gum well with the honey water. The dog lapped and swallowed, even lying down, but most of my attention was on Jamie. I left her howling on her master's grave. Something too faint to be a shiver ran over me, and I felt the hairs on my forearms lift, stirring in the warm draught from the fire. I was morally sure that Jamie had put the dog's master in his grave, and that I was the unwilling cause of it. His face was calm now, shadowed by the fire. Whatever he might be thinking, nothing showed, and his hand was gentle on the dog's spotted fur. Absolution, he'd said.
What was your dog's name, Fanny?
Jem said behind me.
The one you had on the ship?
Spotty, she said, making an effort with the S. It was only a few months since I'd clipped her tongue tie, and she still struggled with some sounds.
He had a white spot on his nose. We could call this one Spotty, too,
Jem offered generously.
If you want. She's got lots of spots. Lots of spots, he repeated, giggling at the rhyme. Lots and lots of spots and spots. Now you're a silly thing, Fanny said to him, laughing.
Maybe you should wait and see if your grandad means to keep her, Jem, Roger said, before you give her a name.
Plainly the possibility that we might not keep the dog hadn't entered the children's heads, and they were aghast at the notion.
Oh, please, Mr. Fraser, Fanny said urgent. I'll feed her. I promise I will. And I'll take the ticks out of her fur, Granda,
Jimmy put in.
Please, please, can we keep her?
Jamie's eyes met mine, and his mouth turned up a little at one side, in resignation, I thought, rather than humour.
She came to me for help, he said to me. I can't very well turn her away.
Then maybe you should name her Da,
Bree put in, quelling Jem's and Fanny's exhibitions of relieved delight.
What would you call her?
Bluebell,
he said without hesitation, surprising me. It's a good Scottish name, and it fits her eye.
Bluebell.
Fanny stroked the dog's back, and the long plumed tail moved lazily to and fro.
Can I call her Bluey, for short?
Jamie did laugh then, and rose slowly to his feet, knees cracking from kneeling on the boards for so long.
Call her anything she'll answer to, lass. But for now she needs her bed, and so do I.
The children coaxed the newly christened Bluebell to come with them, offering more bits of pie crust, and the adults began to gather ourselves, settling for bed. There was a momentary silence as Bree took Mandy from Roger, and as I knelt to smoor the hastily stirred up fire again, I heard Jem's and Fanny's voices on the stair landing.
What happened to your dog Spotty?
Jem asked, the question distant but clear. Fanny's answer was just as clear, and I saw Jamie's head turn sharply toward the open door as he heard it.
"The bad men threw him into the sea," she said. "Can Bluey sleep with me tonight? You can have her tomorrow."
Chapter 17. Reading by Firelight. The framing for the second story was done. It would be some time yet before it was completely walled in and a roof put on. But his nights of cool sleeping under the naked stars with Claire were numbered. Jamie felt a slight pang of regret at the thought, but this was at once eclipsed by the cosy vision of them sleeping in a feather bed before a warm hearth, 3 months hence, the shutters closed against howling wind and plastering snow. He sank slowly into the big chair by the fire, half enjoying the pain as his joints relaxed, both mind and knees knowing that the bliss of rest was at hand. The household was abed, but Claire had gone to a berthing near the bottom of the cove. He missed her, but it was a pleasant pain, like the stretch in his backbone. She would be back, likely tomorrow. For now he had a good fire warming his feet, a glass of soft red wine, and books to hand. He took the spectacles from his pocket, unfolded them, and settled them on his nose. The house's entire library stood in two modest piles on the table beside his wine glass. A small Bible, bound in green cloth, very much the worse for wear. He touched it gently, as he did every time he saw it. It was an old companion, a friend that had seen him through many bad times. A coverless copy of Roxana, The Fortunate Mistress. He'd best take that one up to the bedroom. Jem hadn't shown any interest in it yet, but the lad could certainly read well enough to make out what it was about if he did. A not bad copy of Mr. Pope's translation of the Odyssey. Maybe he'd read a bit of that with Jem. He'd likely find the ships and monsters interesting, and it would be an excuse to cram a bit of Latin into the lad's head while they were about it. Joseph Andrews. A waste of paper, that one. He'd maybe trade it to Hugh Grant, who liked silliness. Manon Lescaut, in French, and a fine Morocco binding. He frowned briefly at that one. He'd not opened it. John Gray had sent it to him before. He grunted irritably, and on impulse took the book at the bottom of the stack. Mandy's Big Bright Orange, Green Eggs and Ham. The colour, the title, and the comical beast on the cover made him smile, and a few minutes with Sam I Am eased his temper. The thump of steps coming down the stairs made him sit up, but it was only Bluebell, who padded up to him, tail wagging gently, sniffed him in case he had any food about his person, gave that up, and went to stand by the back door in a meaningful manner. "Aye, onion," he said, opening the door for her. "Look out for painters." She vanished into the night with a swipe of her tail, but he stood for a moment, looking out and listening to the dark. It was quiet, save for the trees talking among themselves, and he stepped outside and stood looking up at the stars, letting go of the lingering annoyance roused by Manon Lescaut, and letting their peace come into him. Took a deep breath of the fresh piney air, and let it out slowly.
"I forgive you, you bloody wee bugger," he said to John Gray,
and felt the lightning of soul he'd been unconsciously seeking. A rustling in the bushes by the privy heralded the dog's return. He waited for her to finish her industrious sniffing and held the door open for her. She passed him with a brief wag of her tail and bounded softly up the stairs. He felt more settled in himself, and walked a little way by starlight to the red cedar that grew near the well to drink water and pluck a twig. He liked the smell of the berries. Claire told him they were used to flavour gin, which he didn't care for, but the scent was fine. Inside again, the door bolted and the fire poked up, he went back to the books, the cedar twig making a small, fresh smell for him that went well with the wine. He took up one of the small, thick books about hobbits that Bree had brought for him, but even with his spectacles, the print was dense enough to make him feel tired looking at it, and he put it down again, eyes seeking something else in the pile. Not Manon, not yet. His forgiveness was sincere,
but distinctly grudging, and he kent well enough it would need to be repeated a few times before he spoke to John Grey again. No doubt it was the thought of reluctant forgiveness that made him pick up the book Brianna had bought for herself, Frank Randall's book, The Soul of a Rebel. "Hmm," he said, and drew it out of the stack, turning it over in his hands. It felt strange. A good weight and size, sound binding, but the paper cover was printed with a very peculiar tartan background in pink and green, on which there was a square of pale green with a decent wee painting of the basket hilt of a Scottish broadsword and a bit of the blade. Below the square, the subtitle, The Scottish Roots of the American Revolution. What made it feel odd, though, was the fact that it was wrapped in a transparent sheet of something that wasn't paper, slick under his touch. Plastic, Brina had told him when he asked. He kent the word all right, but not with this meaning. He turned the book over to look at the photographs. He was becoming halfway accustomed to photographs, but it still took him back a bit to see the man looking out at him like that. He pressed his thumb firmly over Frank Randall's nose, then lifted it. He tilted the book from side to side, letting light from the fire play over the plastic covering. He'd made a very faint smudge, not visible if you were looking straight at it. Suddenly ashamed of this childishness, he erased the mark with his shirt sleeve and set the book on his knee. The photograph looked calmly up at him through dark-rimmed spectacles. It wasn't only the writer that disturbed him. Hearing bits of what was to come from Claire and Bree and Roger Mack frequently alarmed him, but their physical presence was reassuring. Whatever horrible events were to happen, many folk had survived them. Still, he kent well enough that while none of his family would ever lie to him, they did often temper what they said to him. Frank Randall was another thing, an historian whose account of what was going to happen in the next few years would be... well, he didn't ken exactly what it might be. Frightening, perhaps? Upsetting, maybe? Maybe reassuring? In spots. Frank Randall wasn't smiling, but he looked pleasant enough. Lines in his face that cut deep. Well, the man had been through a war. "To say nothing of being married to Claire," he said aloud, and was surprised at the sound of his voice. He picked up his wine glass and took a mouthful, holding it for a moment, but then swallowed and turned the book over.
"Well, I dinna ken if I forgive you or not, Englishman," he murmured, opening the cover and taking a cleansing breath of cedar. "Or you, me. But let's see what you have to say to me, then."
He woke the next morning to an empty bed, sighed, stretched, and rolled out of it. He thought he'd dream about the events described in Randall's book, but he hadn't. He dreamed rather pleasantly about Achilles' ships, and would have liked to tell Claire about it. He shook off the remnants of sleep and went to wash, making a mental note of some of the things he'd dreamed so as not to forget them. With luck, she'd be home before supper.
"Mr. Fraser?"
A delicate rap on the door. Francis's voice.
"Your daughter says breakfast is ready."
"Aye?" He wasn't smelling anything of a savoury nature, but ready was a relative term. "I'm coming, lass. Tank."
"Tang?"
she said, sounding startled. He smiled, pulled a clean shirt over his head and opened the door. She was standing there like a field daisy, delicate but upright on her stem, and he bowed to her. "Dank," he said, pronouncing it as carefully as he could. It means thanks in the Gaelic.
"Are you sure?"
she said, frowning slightly. "I am," he assured her. "Moran tank means thank you very much should you want something stronger." A faint flush rose in her cheeks.
"I'm sorry. I didn't really mean are you sure. Of course you are. It's only that Jaman told me thank you is... Tabek Leet. Is that wrong?" "He might have been practicing on me, but I didn't think so."
"Tapalat," he said, restraining the urge to laugh.
No, that's right. It's only that mon tank is casual, you might say. The others when you want to be formal. If someone's saved your life or paid your debts, you'd say kapalat. Where if they pass you the bread at table, you'd say tank.
Aye?
Aye, she said automatically, and flushed deeper when he smiled. She smiled back, though, and he followed her down the stairs, thinking how oddly engaging she was. She was reticent, but not shy at all. He supposed one couldn't be shy if raised with the expectation of becoming a whore. Now he could smell Parrish, slightly scorched Parrish. He wrinkled his nose, adjusted his expression to one of stoic pleasantry, and went along to the kitchen, casting an eye at the unfinished walls of his study and the barely framed front room. He might get an hour at the study this afternoon if he was back in time from Madlevah, he said, pausing in the open space where the door would be, next week maybe, to greet the assembled members of his family.
Granda!
Mandy scrambled off her bench, knocking her porridge bowl into the milk jug. Brianna, just sitting down, lunged forward and grabbed it just in time. He caught Mandy and swung her up into his arms, smiling at Jem, Fanny, Jemma, and Brianna.
Mum burnt the porridge, Jem informed him. But there's honey, so you don't notice so much.
It'll be fine, he said, sitting down and setting Mandy on his knee. The honey's no from Claire's bees, is it? They'll need still to settle a bit, eh?
Yes,
Brianna said, and pushed a bowl toward him, followed by milk jug and honey pot. She was flushed herself, doubtless from the heat of the fire.
This is part of Mama's wages from setting Hector MacDonald's broken leg.
Sorry about the porridge. I thought I could make it to the smoke shed and back before it needed to be stirred again.
She nodded toward the hearth, where slices of bacon were just beginning to sputter in the big spider.
Where's your man, lass? He asked tactfully, ignoring her apology and helping himself to a modest drizzle of honey.
One of the McKinnon kids came to fetch him just after daybreak.
You were tired, she added, seeing him frown at the thought that he hadn't heard the visitor.
And no wonder. Don't worry, she said quickly. It wasn't really an emergency. Old Granny McKinnon woke up dying again. That's the third time this month, and wanted a minister.
Oh, the bacon!
She leapt up, but Fanny had already moved to turn the sizzling slices, and Jamie's wame contracted pleasantly at the savoury smoke.
Thank you, Fanny.
Bree sat back down and took up her spoon again.
Mr. Fraser,
Fanny said, waving the smoke away from her eyes.
Aye, lass.
How do you say you're welcome in Gaelic?
Chapter 18. Distant Thunder. I found a shallow, gravelly spot in the creek and hastily wriggled out of my apron and dress, trying not to breathe. Bar gangrenous limbs and long dead corpses, nothing smells worse than pig shit. Nothing. Still holding my breath, I wadded the smeared garments into a loose ball and dropped it into the shallows. I kicked off my shoes and waded in after it, holding a couple of large rocks I'd snatched up. The dress had already begun to unwrap itself, spreading faded indigo swaths out over the gravel like the shadow of a passing manta ray. I dropped the rock on it, and spreading out the canvas apron with my bare foot, weighted that down as well. Crisis managed for the moment. I waded out a little farther and stood calf-deep in the cold, rushing water, breathing gratefully. Animal husbandry was not really my speciality, unless you wanted to count Jamie and the children, but necessity makes veterinarians of us all. I had been visiting young Elmo Cairns's cabin to check on the progress of his broken arm, when his also young and immensely pregnant pig began to show signs of difficulty with her first farrowing. This was noticeable, as the pig had been sprawled, her enormous sides heaving sporadically, on the floor at Elmo's feet, she being, as he explained, somewhat of a pet. Elmo being incapacitated by his broken arm, I had done the necessary, and while the result was gratifying, 100% survival rate, and a healthy litter of 8,
6 of them female. 1 of them mine, Elmo had assured me. If so, doesn't eat them all. I hadn't thought I could make it all the way home wearing the by-products. It was a hot day, with that heavy stillness in the air that portends thunder, and standing in cold water with cool air rising through my undergarments was pleasant. I decided that removing my sweaty stays would make it pleasanter still, and was in the act of pulling these off over my head when I heard a loud cough from the creek bank behind me. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said, jerking the stays off and whirling round. "Who the bloody hell are you?" There were 2 of them, gentlemen, by their rather inappropriate dress. Not that I was in any position to put on airs about appropriate attire, but they did have foxtails stuck in their silk stockings, mud clogged in the buckles of their shoes, and smears of pine pitch on their broadcloth, and one had a large rent in his coat that showed the yellow silk lining. Both of them looked me over from dishevelled head to bare foot, their mouths slightly open, and their gazes lingering on my breasts, which were rather on display, the damp muslin of my shift having stuck to them, and the cool air off the water having stiffened my nipples. Inappropriate, forsooth. I delicately plucked the muslin loose from my skin and dropped it, giving them stare for stare. The one with the rent in his coat recovered first, and nodded to me, a cautious interest in his eyes. "My name is Mr. Adam Granger, and this," nodding at his younger companion, "is my nephew, Mr. Nicodemus Partland. Can you tell us the way to Captain Cunningham's house, my good woman?" "Certainly," I said, resisting the impulse to try to tidy my hair. "It's that way." I pointed toward the northeast. "But it's a good 3 miles. I'm afraid you'll be caught by the storm." They would be, too. A rising breath of air fluttered the leaves of the willows along the creek, and a boil of dark grey clouds was rising in the west. You could see a mountain storm coming from quite a distance, but they moved quickly. Moved in at part by the requirements of hospitality, and in larger part by curiosity, I waded ashore, scooping up my wet clothes. "You'd better come down to the house," I said to Mr. Granger as I wrung out my clothes and folded them up in my stays. "It's quite nearby, and you can shelter there until the storm passes. One of the boys can guide you to Captain Cunningham's place once the rain goes by. His cabin is rather remote." They glanced at each other, up at the darkening sky, and then nodded as one and prepared to follow me. I hadn't liked the way Mr. Partland had eyed my breasts and didn't want him ogling my bottom while I walked. So I gestured them firmly before me onto the trail, pushed my wet feet into my shoes, and set out for home, dripping. I estimated Mr. Granger's age at perhaps 50, Partland younger, perhaps in his mid-30s. Neither was fat, but Nicodemus Partland was tall and rangy, with the sort of eyes that looked past you even as they looked at you. He kept glancing over his shoulder as though to be sure I was still there. We reached the house within 20 minutes, but the air had already begun to smell of ozone, and I could hear thunder rumbling in the distance. "Welcome to New House, gentlemen," I said, nodding toward the front door. Jamie appeared on the threshold, holding Adzo the cat, who leapt out of his arms and hared past me, pursued by Bluebell, barking happily. She skidded to a halt, seeing the strangers, and started barking at them with raised hackles and serious intent. Jamie came down off the porch and took hold of the dog by the scruff of her neck.
"That'll do, lass," he said to her,
and with a gentle shake let her go.
"Your pardon, gentlemen."
Mr. Partland had drawn back when Bluebell menaced them, and had a hand on his pocket, in a way suggesting that he might have a small pistol therein. He didn't take his eyes off the dog, even when Fanny came out, summoned by Jamie, and coaxed her back into the house. Mr. Granger, though, had no eyes for dogs. He was staring at Jamie. Jamie noticed this and offered his hand with a slight bow.
"James Fraser, your servant, sir. That is..."
Mr. Granger shook his head rapidly and took Jamie's hand.
"Mr. Adam Granger, sir. Are you not General Fraser?"
I was, Jamie said briefly. And you, sir?
He turned to Partland, who was now also examining him as he might a horse he meant to buy.
Nicodemus Partland, your most obedient, sir, Partland said, smiling, but with a tone that suggested obedience was the last thing he intended, or respect, for that matter. You're, Mr. Granger, belatedly recalling my presence, turned to look at me. Woman suggested that we might find shelter from the storm here, but if our presence is inconvenient...
Not at all.
Jamie's mouth twitched slightly as he looked me over.
Allow me to introduce my wife, sir.
Mrs. General Freezer.
Fanny appeared in the doorway, coming to see what Bluebell was barking about now, with Brianna behind her. Jamie made the introductions, then motioned the visitors into the house and raised a brow at Bree, who nodded obligingly.
My daughter will see to your needs, gentlemen. I'll join you shortly.
He waited just long enough for them to go inside before turning to me.
What the devil have you been doing, Sassenach?
He hissed. Delivering pigs, I said succinctly, and handed him the bundle of wet clothing from which the unmistakable scent of porcine excrement still oozed, bearing witness to my story.
Christ, he said, holding the bundle out at arm's length. Francis, lass, take this, will you? Soak it in something. Or must it be burnt?
He asked, turning back to me. Soak them in cold water with soft soap and vinegar, I said. We'll boil them later.
And thank you, Fanny.
She nodded and took the bundle, nose wrinkled.
Who are these men?
Jamie asked, jerking his chin toward the door where Partland and Granger had disappeared.
And how the devil did ye come to be in their company in nothing but your shift?
I was washing in the creek when they turned up, I said, rather irritated. I didn't invite them to join me.
No, of course not.
He took a breath and began to calm down.
I just didn't like the way the younger one was looking at you.
Neither did I. As for who they are, I began, but was interrupted by Fanny, who was headed for the side yard and the laundry tub with Bluebell, but turned round at this.
The young one is an officer, she said, and nodded in affirmation of her observations. They always think they can do anything they want.
I stared after her, nonplussed as she vanished.
They don't look like soldiers, I said with a shrug. The older one called me my good woman, though.
They probably thought I was your skivvy.
My what?
He looked startled, and then offended.
Oh, it just means a cleaning woman, I said, realizing that he'd leapt to a not unreasonable 18th-century interpretation of the meaning of skivvy.
Anyway, they said they were looking for Captain Cunningham, and as it was about to rain...
It was. The wind was moving through the grass and through leaves and needles and twigs. The whole forest was breathing, and the clouds had covered more than half the sky, big, black, and dangerous, with flickering lightning.
Brianna came out holding a towel and offered it to me.
I put those men in your study, Da, she said. Is that all right?
Aye, fine, he assured her.
Wait, Bree, I said, emerging from the towel as she turned to go. Would you and Fanny go down to the root cellar and fetch up some vegetables and maybe,
oh, I don't know,
something sweet, jam, raisins? We'll have to feed them, whoever they are.
Sure, she said. You don't know who they are. Fanny says the young one is an officer, Jamie said. Beyond that, we'll see. Come along in, Sassenach, he said, putting an arm about me to shepherd me inside. You need to get dry.
And clothed?
Aye, that too.
The root cellar wasn't a long walk from the smoke shed, but it was on the other side of the big clearing, and the wind, unobstructed by trees or buildings, rushed them from behind, blowing their skirts out before them and whipping Fanny's cap off her head. Brianna got a hand up and snatched the scrap of muslin as it whirled past.
Her own hair, unbound, was flailing round her face, and so was Fanny's. They looked at each other, half-blinded, and laughed. Then the first drops of rain began to fall, and they ran, gasping and shrieking, for the shelter of the root cellar. It was dug into the side of a hill, a rough wooden door framed in with stacked stone on either side. The door stuck in its jamb, but Bree freed it with a mighty jerk, and they fell inside, damp spotted, but safe from the downpour that now commenced outside. "Here!" Still breathless, Brianna gave the cap to Fanny. "I don't think it'll keep the rain out, though." Fanny shook her head, sneezed, giggled, and sneezed again.
"Where's yours?"
she asked, sniffing as she tucked her wind-blown curls back under the cap. "I don't like caps much," Bree said, and smiled when Fanny blinked. "But I might wear one for cooking or doing something splashy. I wear a slouch hat for hunting sometimes, but otherwise I just tie my hair back."
"Oh," Fanny said uncertainly, "I guess, that's why Mrs. Fraser, your mother, I mean, why she doesn't wear them either."
"Well, it's a little different with Mama," Bree said, running her fingers through her own long red hair to untangle it. "It's part of her war with..." She paused for a moment, wondering how much to say. But after all, if Fanny was now part of the family, she'd learn such things sooner or later. "With people who think they have a right to tell her how to do things."
Fanny's eyes went round. "Don't they?"
"I'd like to see anybody try," Bree said dryly, and having twisted her hair into an untidy bun, turned to survey the contents of the cellar. She felt a rush of relief and reassurance, seeing at once that a good 3/4 of the shallow shelves were filled. Potatoes, turnips, apples, yams, and the bright green ovoids of slowly ripening pawpaws. 2 large lumpy burlap bags stood against the far wall, probably full of nuts of some kind. Though surely local nuts hadn't ripened yet. Perhaps her parents had traded for them. And the cellar was filled with the sweet wine scent of drying muscats, hung in clusters from the low ceiling to crinkle into raisins. "Mama's been busy," she said, automatically turning the potatoes on one shelf as she selected a dozen to take. "I suppose you have too," she added, smiling at Fanny. "You helped gather all of this, I'm sure." Fanny looked down modestly, but glowed a little.
"I dug up the turnips and some of the potatoes," she said. "There were a lot growing in that place they called Old Garden. Under the weeds?"
"Old Garden," Bree repeated. "Yes, I suppose so." A shiver that had nothing to do with the chill of the root cellar rose up her neck and contracted her scalp. She'd heard about Mulver Christie's death in the garden, and the death of her unborn child. Under the weeds, indeed. She glanced sidelong at Fanny, who was twisting an onion off its braid, but the girl showed no emotion about the garden. Probably no one had told her, yet, Bree thought, about what had happened there, and why the garden had been abandoned to the weeds.
"Should we take more potatoes?"
Fanny asked, dropping 2 fat yellow onions into the basket.
"And maybe apples for fritters? If it doesn't stop raining, those men will stay the night, and we haven't any eggs for breakfast."
"Good idea," Bree said, quite impressed at Fanny's housewifely forethought. The remark turned her mind, though, to the mysterious visitors.
"What you said to Da
about one of the men being an officer? How did you know that?" "And how did Da know you would know something like that?" she added silently. Fanny looked at her for a long moment, her face quite expressionless. Then she seemed suddenly to have made up her mind about something, for she nodded, as though to herself.
"I've seen them," she said simply, "lots of times. At the brothel. At the..."
Brianna nearly dropped the pawpaw she'd picked off the upper shelf. Her mother had told her about Fanny's past, but she hadn't expected Fanny to bring it up.
"Brothel," Fanny repeated. The word clipped short.
Bree had turned to look at her. She was pale, but her eyes were steady under her cap.
"In Philadelphia.
I see.
Brianna hoped her own voice and eyes were as steady as Fanny's and tried to speak calmly, in spite of the inner appalled voice saying, Jesus Lord, she's only 11 or 12 now.
Did, Da, is that where he found you?
Fanny's eyes welled quite suddenly with tears, and she turned hurriedly away, fumbling with a shelf of apples.
No, she said in a muffled voice. My sister, we ran away together.
Your sister, Bree said carefully.
Where? She's fled.
Oh, Fanny. She dropped the pawpaw, but it didn't matter. She grabbed Fanny and held her tight as though she could somehow smother the dreadful sorrow that oozed between them, squeeze it out of existence. Fanny was shaking silently. Oh, Fanny, she said again softly, and rubbed the girl's back as she would have done for Jem or Mandy, feeling the delicate bones beneath her fingers. It didn't last long. After a moment, Fanny got hold of herself. Bree could feel it happen, a stopping, a drawing in of the flesh, and stepped back out of Bree's embrace.
It's all right, she said, blinking fast to keep more tears from coming. It's all right. She's safe now.
She drew a deep breath and straightened her back.
After it happened, William gave me to Mr. Fraser.
Oh. A thought struck her, and she looked uncertainly at Bree.
Do you know about William?
For a moment, Bree's mind was completely blank.
William?
But suddenly the penny dropped, and she looked at Fanny, startled.
William?
You mean Mr. Fraser's Da's son? Saying the word brought him to life, the tall young man, cat-eyed and long-nosed like her, but dark where she was fair, speaking to her on the quay in Wilmington.
Yes, Fanny said, still a little wary. I think, does that mean he's your brother?
Half-brother, yes. Brianna felt dazed and bent to pick up the fallen fruit.
You said he gave you to Da?
Yes. Fanny took another breath and bent to pick up the last apple. Standing, she looked Bree straight in the eye.
Do you mind?
No, Bree said softly, and touched Fanny's tender cheek. Oh, Fanny, no. Not at all. Jamie could see at once that the younger man was indeed a soldier. He thought the older one was not. And while the younger man took care to defer to Granger, Jamie thought that Partland had some ascendancy over the older and richer man. Or at least he thinks he does, he thought, smiling pleasantly as he poured wine for the visitors in his study. He didn't much like Partland, and was inclined to think the feeling was mutual, though he didn't know why. Yet.
You'll stay till the morning, Mr. Granger, he asked with a wary glance at the ceiling. Night's falling, and the storm has the feel of a settled rain about it. You'll not want to be feeling your way about the woods in the dreich dark.
The rain had begun to patter above, and he felt the mingled pride of a man with a sound ceiling built by himself, and the lingering fear that it might be not quite as sound as he hoped.
We will, General, Partland answered, and my uncle and I thank you for your kind hospitality.
He lifted his cup in salute. Granger looked somewhat taken aback by this usurpation of his seniority, but the men exchanged a look, and whatever intelligence passed between them, it was effective. Granger relaxed, murmuring his own thanks.
You're very welcome, gentlemen, Jamie said, sitting down behind his desk with his own cup.
He'd had to fetch a stool from the kitchen for Partland, having only a single cane-bottomed chair for a guest in his study. At least he'd got the room walled in, so there was a sense of snug privacy separated from the kitchen, where Claire, decently clad again, was apparently beating a recalcitrant piece of tough venison into edibility with a mallet.
I must invite you to call me Mr. Freezeroo, he added, smiling to avoid any sense of rebuke. I resigned my commission following Monmouth, and have no present association with the Continental Army.
Do you not indeed?
Granger sat up a little, straightening his coat to hide the tear.
That's modest of you, sir. I have usually found that any man who has held a military post of any pretension clings to his title for life.
Partland kept his face carefully blank. Jamie thought it was hiding a smirk, and felt a flicker of annoyance, but dismissed it.
I canna say but what many officers deserve to keep their titles, sir, as the result of retirement following long and honourable service. I'm sure that's the case with your friend Captain Cunningham, is it not?
Well, yes.
Granger looked somewhat abashed.
I apologise, Mr. Fraser. I meant no offence regarding your own choice in the matter of title.
None taken, sir.
Have you kept the captain for some time, then?
Why, yes, I have, Granger said, relaxing a bit. The captain greatly obliged me some years ago by rescuing one of my ships from a French corsair off Martinique. I called upon him with my thanks, and in the course of conversation discovered that we held many opinions in common. We became friends, and have kept up a correspondence for, gracious me, it must be 20 years now at least.
Ah, you're a merchant, then?
That explained the yellow silk lining the man's coat, which had probably cost as much as the wardrobe for Jamie's entire household.
Yes, in the rum trade, mostly. But the present war has caused considerable difficulties, I'm afraid.
Jamie made a non-committal noise meant to indicate polite regret and a disinclination to engage in political discourse. Mr. Granger appeared quite willing to leave it at that, but Partland sat forward, putting his cup down on the desk.
I trust you'll pardon my impertinence, Mr. Fraser.
He smiled without showing his teeth.
It's just my curiosity, to be sure. What was the cause of your leaving Washington's army, if I may ask?
Jamie wanted to tell him he mightn't, but he wanted to know things about Partland too, so answered equably.
General Washington appointed me as an emergency measure, sir. General Henry Taylor having died only a few days before the battle, and Washington requiring someone with experience to lead General Taylor's militia companies. However, most of those companies were enlisted for only 3 months, and their enlistment expired very shortly following Monmouth. There was no longer any need for my services.
Ah. Partland was regarding him quizzically, trying to decide whether to say what he had in mind. He did say it, though, and Jamie was surprised to find that he had been keeping a mental checklist, on which he now made a mark next to the word reckless, right under greasy as goose fat.
But surely the Continental Army could find continued use for a soldier of your experience. From what I hear, they are scouring the armies of Europe for officers, no matter what their experience or reputation.
Jamie made the same noise, slightly louder. Granger made an English version of the same thing, but Partland ignored them both.
I had heard some talk, mere ill-natured gossip, I'm sure.
He waved a hand dismissively, to the effect that you had left the field of battle before being relieved of your duty,
and that this contretemps had somehow resulted in your resignation. Gossip is somewhat better informed in this case than it usually is, Jamie answered evenly. My wife was badly wounded on the field. She is a surgeon, and was caring for the casualties. And I resigned my commission in order to save her life. And that's all you're going to hear about it, numpty.
Granger cleared his throat again and looked reprovingly at his nephew, who sat back and picked up his cup with a negligent air, though still with a sidelong look. The muffled, regular blows of Claire's mallet were audible through the uninsulated wall, somewhat slower than Jamie's heartbeat, which had sped up noticeably. Taking a deep breath to slow it down, he picked up the wine bottle, weighing it. Half full, enough to keep them going till supper.
Would you tell me something of the rum trade, sir?
he said, freshening Granger's cup. I worked for a time in Paris, dealing mostly in wine, but with a small trade in spirits as well.
That was 35 years ago, though. I imagine a few things have changed.
The atmosphere in the study eased, and the mallet blows stopped. Conversation became general and amiable. The roof wasn't leaking. Jamie relaxed for the moment, sipping wine. He was going to have to talk to Bobby and Roger Mack about Captain Cunningham. Tomorrow. Bobby Higgins turned up on the doorstep just after noon the next day. He was dressed in a clean shirt and breeches, with his good waistcoat and a lace-trimmed neckcloth, which rather alarmed Jamie. This degree of fastidiousness meant Bobby was worried about something, and hoped to placate the fury of the gods by means of plaited hair and starched cloth.
"Amy said Mrs. Goodwin told her that your sister said you wanted to speak with me, sir," he said at once.
He bobbed his head anxiously, eyes fixed on Jamie for any clue as to what might be coming.
"Och, that's all right, Bobby," Jamie said, stepping back and gesturing him in. "I only wanted to ask what you might know about Captain Cunningham. A couple of fellows came by yesterday on their way to visit him." "Oh," said Bobby, relaxing visibly. "The bad guys."
"The what?"
"That's what little Mandy called them," Bobby said, holding his hand level by his thigh and about the height of Mandy's head. "She said they looked like bad guys and wanted me to go shoot them."
Jamie smiled, not quite surprised at Mandy's acute perceptions, but appreciating them.
"What did you think of them yourself, Bobby?"
Bobby shook his head.
"I didn't see them. The little uns were playing up by the spring house and saw two strange men go by. They came home and told me, and I wondered aloud who they were, and Jermaine told me they were looking for Captain Cunningham, so that'll be the same fellows, I expect." "I expect so. Will you join me in a can of ale, Bobby?"
The ale was remarkably bad. Fanny and Brianna had made it, but it was strongly alcoholic, and they drank it without complaint, talking over the tenants and any concerns Bobby might have.
"I'm thinking it's maybe time we raised a militia company, Bobby," Jamie said casually.
To his surprise, Bobby nodded soberly.
"Past time, maybe, sir, if you'll forgive me saying so."
"I will," Jamie said wary. "But what makes ye say so?"
"Josiah Beardsley was by 2 days ago, and told me that he'd seen a group of men in the forest between here and the Blowing Rock, armed men, and he was sure that he'd seen at least one red coat among them."
Bobby took a swig of beer and wiped his mouth, adding, "It's not the first I've heard of such a group, but these men were closer than any I've heard of."
"Aye," Jamie said softly.
He remembered what he told Brianna when she told him about Rob Cameron, and the hairs prickled at the base of his spine.
"Someone will come."
He doubted that these men had anything to do with the wicked buggers that had tried to kill his daughter in her own home and her own time. But these days, someone could be a threat regardless.
"The sooner the better, then. Make me a list, will you, Bobby? What kind of arms every man on the ridge has to hand? Whether it's a musket or a scythe. Even a skinning knife will do."
In the event, it was Rachel who told him all about Captain Cunningham. He'd meant to lend Roger Mack and Richard McNeil a hand with the roof tree of the new church, and had come by Ian's cabin to see if the lad would come along. With 4 men, they could have half the roof on by sunset. It wasn't a large building. He found Rachel alone, though, peacefully churning butter on the porch of her cabin, aspen shadows fluttering over her like a cloud of transparent butterflies.
"Ian's gone hunting with one of the Beardsleys, Jamie," she told him, smiling but not missing a stroke. "Thy sister has taken Oggie to visit Aggie McElroy, I think for the purpose of exhibiting him as a terrible example in hopes of keeping Aggie's youngest daughter from marrying the first young man who asks her."
"That would be Katrina," he asked,
running through his mental map of the ridge.
"She's nae more than 14, surely."
13, but ripe, I believe. She'll not wait long. No great sense in the girl, she said, shaking her head. She drew breath and went on, though in fairness, it's as much fear as lust or desire for novelty, she added, gasping slightly, though her shoulders kept moving evenly. She is the youngest, and fears that she will be compelled to remain unwed in order to care for her parents, as they grow elderly, if she does not escape, before they begin actually to dodder.
Gordon McElroy was 5 years younger than himself, Jamie reflected, and Aggie, maybe 45. He wondered whether he would notice if he was doddering or not.
You're a keen observer of human nature, lass, he said, smiling.
I am, she said, smiling back, though I cannot claim much perception with regard to Katrina, as she told me of her feelings herself. Rachel had been working for some time. The day was warm, but sweat darkened the edge of her fichu, and her skin, normally the colour of cream with a spoonful of coffee, had taken on a pink bloom. On an impulse, he stepped up onto the porch beside her, and reaching out, took the handle of the churn, nudging her aside without missing a stroke.
"Sit, lassie," he said. "Rest for a bit, and tell me if you ken anything about Captain Cunningham."
"Thee is much too tall for that churn," she said, but sat down nonetheless on the edge of the porch, stretching out her legs and shrugging her shoulders with a sigh of relief.
"The butter will come soon," he said.
"Won't it?"
It had been a long time since he'd churned butter himself. Perhaps 50 years? That thought disturbed him, and he churned slightly faster.
"It will,"
she said, turning her head to frown up at him. "But not unless thee goes more slowly."
"Oh, aye."
He obediently slowed to her previous rhythm, enjoying the sense of a heavy liquid moving to and fro in the churn with a soft rhythmic slosh.
"Have you seen the captain at all?"
"Oh, yes," she said, slightly surprised. "I met his mother a few weeks ago, soon after they came. In the forest, gathering comfrey. We talked for a bit, and I helped her carry her baskets to her house. Her son was very kind and offered me tea."
She raised an eyebrow to see whether he appreciated this bit of intelligence, which he did.
"I dinna suppose anyone in the back country has even seen tea in the last 5 years."
"No," she said thoughtfully. "He said that he has friends from his naval career who are so kind as to send him a small chest of tea and other dainties now and then."
"He said, soon after they came. When did they come?"
"At the end of April. Bobby Higgins told me that the captain told him that, like Odysseus, he had walked away from the sea with an oar on his shoulder until he came to a place where no one knew what it was, and having found such a place, proposed to stay, if he could."
Jamie couldn't help smiling at that.
"Does Bobby ken who Odysseus was?"
"He didn't, but I told him a bit of the story and explained that the captain had been speaking metaphorically. The captain made Bobby rather nervous, I think," she added delicately. "But there was no good reason to deny him, and he paid 5 years' rent in advance. In cash."
Any figure of government authority would make Bobby nervous, with the murderer's brand on his face. This, inflicted after a skirmish in Boston, where he was a soldier, had left a citizen dead.
"Seems that people tell you a great many things, Rachel," he said.
She looked up at him, hazel-eyed and open-faced, and nodded.
"I listen," she said simply.
She knew a number of small things regarding the Cunninghams, for she stopped now and then at their cabin when she'd been foraging in their vicinity. It was no more than a mile and a half, to share if she had extra of something. None of the things she knew seemed unusual, though, save that Cunningham had confided to her a desire to preach.
To preach?
Jamie nearly stopped churning, but a certain resistance reminded him that the butter was coming, and he continued.
Did he say why, or how?
He did, evidently when he was a sea captain. Preached to his men, I mean, on Sundays aboard his ship. I gather that he found it gratifying and had a notion when he retired of becoming a lay preacher. He has no real idea of how that might be accomplished, but his mother assured him that God would find a way.
The news of the captain's desire to preach was surprising, but also something of a comfort. Still, he reminded himself, there were a good many preachers who would call down hellfire in the service of an army, and having a vocation to preach didn't limit a man's beliefs in other directions. It wasn't likely that a retired sea captain of the British Navy would have strong tendencies toward independency for the American colonies. And he didn't think wee Francis's observations regarding Mr. Partland were in any way mistaken.
"Do you ken that Roger and Brianna called on them and were shown the door for their trouble?" he asked. "I think the butter's come."
She rose, smoothing her dark hair back under her cap, and came to look. She took the churn handle, worked it a few times, and nodded.
"Yes, Brianna told me. I think," she added delicately, "that perhaps Roger should try to speak with friend Cunningham in the absence of his mother."
"Perhaps he should."
He pulled off the top of the churn, and they looked in to see the flakes and clumps of pale gold butter swimming in the cream. Chapter 19. Daylight Haunting. It was a beautiful day, and I had persuaded Jamie, with some difficulty, that the world would not end if he didn't hang the door for the kitchen today. Instead, we collected the children and walked up through the woods toward Ian's cabin, bearing small presents for Rachel, Jenny, and Oggy.
"What will you wager, Miss Athanach, that they've settled on a name for yon wee man?"
"What odds?" I said, diverted. "And are you betting that they have, or that they haven't?"
5-2 against, as to stakes."
He glanced round to see that our companions weren't within hearing distance and lowered his voice.
"Your drawers."
My drawers were, in fact, the lower half of a planned pair of flannel pyjamas made with an oncoming winter in mind.
"And what on earth would you do with my drawers?"
"Burn them."
"No bet. Besides, I don't think they've chosen a name yet either. The last suggestions I heard were Shadrach, Gilbert, and whatever the Mohawk might be for farts like a goat."
"Let me guess. It was Jenny suggested that last one."
"Who would know goats better?"
Bluebell snuffled energetically through the layers of crackling leaves, tail moving to and fro like a metronome. "Can you train that sort of dog to hunt for specific things?" I asked. "I mean, I know it's called a coonhound, but plainly she isn't looking for raccoons right now."
"She's no a coonhound, though I suppose she wouldn't have passed one up." "What did you want her to hunt for, Sathnach?" Jamie asked, smiling. "Truffles."
"You need a pig for that, don't you? And speaking of pigs, Jemmy, Jemma, keep an eye out for pigs, and watch Mandy."
The boys were squatting by a pine tree, picking bits of bark shaped like puzzle pieces off it, but at my call they looked vaguely round.
"Where is Mandy?" I shouted.
"Up there,"
Germain called, pointing upslope,
"with Fanny."
"Germain,
Germain, look, I got a thousand, they got a big one."
At Jem's call, Germain instantly lost interest in the girls and squatted beside Jem, scrabbling dried leaves out of the way.
"Had I better go look, do you think?" I asked.
"Millipedes aren't venomous, but the big centipedes can have a nasty bite."
"The lad can count," Jamie assured me. "If he says it's got a thousand legs, I'm sure it does, give or take a few."
He gave a short whistle, and the dog looked up, instantly alert.
"Go find Francis and Ian."
He flung out an arm, pointing uphill, and the dog barked once, agreeably, and bounded up the rocky slope, yellow leaves exploding under her eager feet.
"Do you think she..." I began. But before I could finish, I heard the girls' voices above, mingled with Bluey's excited yaps of greeting. "Oh, she does know who Francis is, then?"
"Of course she does. She kens all of us now, but she likes Francis best."
He smiled a little at the thought. It was true. Fanny adored the dog and spent hours combing her fur, taking ticks out of her ears, or curled up by the fire with a book, Bluebell comfortably snoring on her feet. "Why do you always call her Frances?" I asked curiously. "Everybody else calls her Fanny." "She calls herself that, for that matter."
"Fanny is a horse name," he replied tersely.
Seeing my look of astonishment, though, his expression relaxed a bit.
"Aye, I ken there are respectable women with that name. But Roger Mack tells me Cleland's novel is still in print in your time."
"Cleland's... Oh, John Cleland, you mean. Fanny Hill?" My voice rose slightly less in surprise that the famously pornographic memoirs of a woman of pleasure were still going strong 250 years on. Some things never go out of style, after all, than at the fact that he'd been discussing it with Roger.
"And he tells me that the word is a vulgarism for a woman's privates," he added, frowning.
"Well, it will be," I admitted.
"Or for someone's bottom, depending whether you come from Britain or America.
But it hasn't got that meaning now, does it?"
"No," he admitted reluctantly. "But still..." "Lord John told me once that Fanny Laycock is a cant term for whore."
His brow furrowed.
"I did wonder. Her sister gave her name as Jane Eleonora Pocock. I thought it maybe wasn't her real name, but more a nom de guerre," I suggested dryly. "I shouldn't wonder.
Does Poe mean a chamber pot these days?"
"Poe de chambre?" he asked in surprise. "Of course it does."
"Of course it does," I murmured. "Putting that aside, if Pocock wasn't her real last name, do you think Fanny, Frances, knows what the real one is?" He shook his head, looking slightly troubled.
"I didn't like to ask her," he said. "She hasn't spoken again about whatever it was that happened to her parents, has she?"
"Not to me. And if she told anyone else, I think they'd have mentioned it to you or me."
"Do you think she's forgotten?"
"I think she doesn't want to remember, which may not be the same thing." He nodded at that, and we walked in silence for a bit, letting the peace of the woods settle with the slow rain of rustling leaves. I could hear the children's voices under and over the rustle of the chestnut leaves, like the calling of distant birds.
"Besides," Jamie said, "William called her Frances when he gave her to me."
We walked on slowly, pausing now and then as I spotted something edible, medicinal, or fascinating, which required a stop every few feet. "Ooh," I said, heading for a slash of deep bloody red at the foot of a tree. "Look at that."
"It looks like a slice of fresh deer's liver," Jamie said, peering over my shoulder. "But it doesn't smell like blood, so I'm guessing it's one of the things you call shelf funguses."
"Very astute of you. Fistulina hepatica," I said, whipping out my knife. "Here, hold this, would you?" He accepted my basket with no more than a slight roll of the eyes and stood patiently while I cut the fleshy chunks, for there was a whole nest of them, hidden under the drifted leaves, like a set of crimson lily pads, free of the tree. I left the smaller ones to grow, but still had at least 2 pounds of the meaty mushroom. I packed them in layers of damp leaves, but broke off a small piece and offered it to Jamie.
"One side makes you taller, and one side makes you small," I said, smiling. "What?"
"Alice in Wonderland, the caterpillar. I'll tell you later." "It's said to taste rather like raw beef," I said. Muttering, "caterpillar," under his breath, he accepted the bit, turned it from side to side, inspecting it critically to be sure it harbored no insidious legs, then popped it in his mouth and chewed, eyes narrowed in concentration. He swallowed, and I relaxed a little.
"Maybe like very old beef that's been hung a long time," he allowed. "But I, a man, could stomach it."
"That's actually a very good commendation for a raw mushroom," I said, pleased. "If I had a few anchovies to hand, I'd make you a nice tartare sauce to go with it."
Anchovies, he said thoughtfully.
I haven't had an anchovy in years.
He licked his lower lip in memory.
I might find some next time I go to Wilmington.
I looked at him in surprise. Are you planning to go to Wilmington soon?
I thought I might,
he said casually.
Do you want to come, Sassenach? I thought you'd maybe be busy with the preserving.
While it was perfectly true that I ought to be spending every waking hour in picking, finding, catching, smoking, salting, or preserving food, when not grinding, infusing, or decocting medicines, it was equally true that I ought to be replenishing our stocks of needles, pins, sugar. That was a good point. I'd need more sugar to be making the fruit preserves, and thread, to say nothing of other bits of household ironmongery and the medicines I couldn't find or make, like ether. And if you came right down to it, wild horses couldn't keep me from going with him. Jamie knew it too. I could see the side of his mouth curling. Before I could either gracefully accept his offer or poke him in the ribs, an unearthly yodel sounded through the trees, and Bluebell shot down the hill in front of us, all four children in hot pursuit, likewise baying.
What was that about, raccoons, Sassenach?
Jamie squinted toward the distant tree under which the hound had taken up residence, her front feet on the trunk, pointing her muzzle up into the branches and letting out ear-piercing howls. Rather to my surprise, it was a raccoon. Fat, grey, immense, and extremely irascible at being roused before nightfall. It filled a jagged hollow halfway up a lightning-struck pine and was peering out in a belligerent way. I thought it was growling, but nothing could be heard over the wild cries of dog and children. Jamie hushed all of them, except the dog, and eyed the coon with a hunter's natural avidity. So, I noticed, did Jem. Germain and Fanny had drawn close together, looking up wide-eyed at the raccoon, and Mandy was wrapped tightly round my leg.
"I don't want it to bite me," she said, clutching my thigh. "Don't let it bite me, Granda."
"I want an Ian, dinna fash yourself."
Not taking his eyes off the treed raccoon, Jamie unslung the rifle from his back and reached for the shot pouch on his belt.
"Can I do it, Granda? Please, can I shoot it?"
Jem was itching to get his hands on the rifle, rubbing them up and down his breeches. Jamie glanced at him and smiled, but then his gaze shifted to Germain.
Or so I thought. "Let Francis try, aye?"
he said, and held out his hand to the startled girl. I rather expected her to recoil in horror, but after a moment's hesitation, a glow rose in her cheeks, and she stepped bravely forward.
"Show me how," she said, sounding breathless.
Her eyes flickered from gun to coon and back, as though fearing one or both would disappear. Jamie normally carried his rifle loaded, but not always primed. He crouched on one knee and laid the gun along his thigh, handed her a half-filled cartridge, and explained how to pour the powder into the pan. Jem and Germain watched jealously, occasionally butting in with know-it-all remarks like,
"That's a frizzin', Fanny," or, "You want to hold it up close to your shoulder so it won't break your face when it goes off."
Jamie and Fanny both ignored these helpful interjections, and I towed Mandy off to a safe distance and sat down on a battered stump, putting her on my lap. Bluebell and the raccoon had continued their vocal warfare, and the forest rang with howling and a sort of high-pitched, angry squealing. Mandy had put her hands dramatically over her ears, but removed them to inquire whether I knew how to shoot a gun. "Yes," I said, avoiding any elaborations. I did technically know how, and had in fact discharged a firearm several times in my life. I'd found it deeply unnerving, though, the more so after I'd been shot myself at the Battle of Monmouth, and understood the effects on a truly visceral level. I preferred stabbing, all things considered.
"Ma'am can shoot anything," Mandy noted, frowning in disapproval at Fanny, who was now holding the wobbling weapon to her shoulder, looking simultaneously thrilled and terrified.
Jamie crouched behind her, steadying the gun, his hand on hers, adjusting her grip and her sights, his voice a low rumble, barely audible under the racket.
"Go to your granny," he said to the boys, raising his voice.
His eyes were fixed on the coon, which had fluffed itself to twice the normal size, and was hurling insults at Bluebell, completely ignoring its audience. Jem and Germain, reluctantly but obediently, came to stand beside me, a safe distance away, or at least I hope so. I repressed the urge to make them move farther off. The gun went off with a sharp bang that made Mandy scream. I didn't, but it was a near thing. Bluey dropped to all fours and seized the raccoon, which had been knocked out of the tree by the shot. I couldn't tell whether it was dead already, but she gave it a tremendous neck-breaking shake, dropped the bloody carcass, and let out a high, warbling howl of triumph. The boys scrambled forward, yelling and pounding Fanny excitedly on the back. Fanny herself was open-mouthed, stunned. Her face had gone pale, what could be seen of it, behind a mottling of black powder smoke, and she kept looking from the gun in her hands to the dead raccoon, plainly unable to believe it.
"Well done, Frances."
Jamie patted her gently on the head and took the gun from her trembling hands.
"Shall the lads gut and skin it for ye?"
Yes. Yes. Please," she added.
She glanced at me, but instead of coming to sit down, walked unsteadily over to Bluey and fell to her knees in the leaves beside the dog.
"Good dog,"
she said, hugging the hound, who happily licked her face. I saw Jamie glance carefully at the dog as he stooped to pick up the blood-splotched carcass, but Bluey made no objection, merely woofling in her throat. After the noise of the hunt, if one could call it that, and I suppose one could, the forest seemed abnormally silent, as though even the wind had stopped blowing. The boys were still excited, but they settled down to the absorbing business of skinning and gutting the raccoon, insisting that Fanny come and admire their skill. With the loud part over, Mandy joined in enthusiastically, asking, "What's that?" as each new bit of internal anatomy was revealed. Jamie sat down by me, set the rifle at his feet, and relaxed, watching the children with a benevolent eye. I was less relaxed. I could still feel the echo of the rifle shot in my bone marrow, and was both surprised and disturbed at the feeling. I looked away, and breathed deep, trying to replace the bright smell of fresh blood with the mellower scents of the forest and the musk of fungi. That last thought made me glance down at my basket, where the fleshy raw red of the Fistulina hepatica showed in gashes through the layers of damp leaves. My gorge rose suddenly, and so did I.
"Sassanach?"
Jamie's voice came from behind me, startled.
"Are you all right?"
I was leaning against an aspen tree, gripping the paper-white trunk for support, trying not to hear the noises of disembowelment going on a few yards away.
"Fine," I said, through numb lips.
I closed my eyes briefly, opened them to see a trickle of half-dried sap running from a crack in the aspen's trunk, the dark red of dried blood, let go, and sat down heavily in the leaves.
"Sassanach."
His voice was low, urgent, but pitched softly so as not to alarm the children. I swallowed heavily, once, twice, then opened my eyes.
"I'm all right," I said. "A little dizzy, that's all."
"You're as white as that tree, Ian. Here."
He reached into his sporran and came out with a small flask.
"Whiskey."
And I gulped it gratefully, letting it fill my mouth and sear away the taste of blood. Cries and laughter from the children. I glanced over his shoulder and saw that Bluey was rolling ecstatically in the discarded viscera, the white parts of her coat now stained a dirty brown. I leaned over and threw up, whiskey and bile coming up the back of my nose.
"Aye,"
Jamie muttered, dabbing at my face with his handkerchief.
"Did ye eat any mushrooms yourself, lass? Are ye poisoned?"
I waved the cloth away, taking deep breaths. "No, I'm all right, truly." I swallowed again. "Can I?" I reached for the flask, and he thrust it into my hand. "Sip it," he advised, and rising, went down to the children, whom he sorted in quick order. The meat and skin were packed into my basket, the remnants shoveled behind a tree out of my sight, and the children sent down to the distant creek with firm instructions to wash themselves and the dog.
"Your granny's a bit tired from the walk, M'Lennan," he said with a quick glance at me. "We'll just rest here for a bit till you come back. Amanda, stay by Frances and mind her, aye? And you lads keep a sharp eye out. It's no good idea to prance through the woods smelling of blood. You see any pigs? Get the girls up a tree and sing out. Oh, ye'd best have this," he said, picking up the rifle and handing it to Jem, "just in case." He gave Germain the shot pouch and watched as they made their way down the slope toward the sound of water, more subdued now, but still giggling and arguing as they went.
"So then,"
he sat down beside me, eyeing me closely. "Really, I'm all right," I said. And I did, in fact, feel much better physically, though there was still a deep quiver in my bones.
"Aye, I can see ye are,"
he said cynically. He didn't push further, though, just sat beside me, forearms resting on his knees, relaxed, but ready for anything that might happen.
"Je suis prêt,"
I said, trying to smile despite the thin layer of cold sweat that covered my face.
"I don't suppose you have any salt in your sporran, do you?" "Of course I do,"
he said, surprised, and reaching in, withdrew a small twist of paper.
"Is it good when you're peely-wally?"
"Maybe." I touched a finger to the salt and put a few grains on my tongue. The taste was cleansing, rather to my surprise. I followed it with a cautious sip of whiskey and felt remarkably better. "I don't know why I asked," I said, handing him back the twist. "Salt is supposed to lay ghosts, though, isn't it?" A faint smile touched his mouth as he looked at me.
"Aye," he said. "So what's haunting you, Sassenach?"
It would have been easy to brush it off, ignore it, but quite suddenly I couldn't do that any longer. "Why doesn't the dog trouble you?" I said bluntly. His face went blank for a moment, and he looked away, but only to think. He blinked once or twice, sighed, and turned back to me with the air of one girding his loins for something unpleasant.
"She did," he said quietly. "When I heard the howling that first night, I thought, well, you'll maybe ken what I thought."
"That perhaps her master had come with her? Had maybe put her on your trail?" My own voice was little more than a whisper, but he heard me and nodded slowly.
"Aye,"
he said, just as softly. I saw his throat move as he swallowed.
"To think that I'd maybe brought something home."
I swallowed myself, but had to say it.
"You did?"
His eyes met mine and sharpened, a dark blue nearly black in the shade of the chestnuts. His mouth tightened, but he didn't say anything for a minute.
"When she came alone," he said at last, "and came to me, looking for shelter, for food. And then when the bairns took her to her at once, and she to them."
He looked away as though embarrassed.
"I thought she maybe was sent, Ken, as a sign of forgiveness. And maybe, by taking her in, I could..."
He made a small, helpless gesture with his maimed hand.
"Make it go away?"
He took a deep breath, and his fists flexed briefly, then relaxed.
"No. Forgiveness doesn't make things go away. You ken that as well as I do."
He turned his head to look at me in curiosity.
"Don't you?"
There were no more than a few inches between us, but the aching distance between our hearts reached miles. Jamie was silent for a long time. I could hear my heart beating in my ears.
"Listen,"
he said at last. "I'm listening." He looked sideways at me, and the ghost of a smile touched his mouth. He held out a broad, pitch-stained palm to me.
"Give me your hands while you do it, aye?"
"Why?" but I put my hands into his without hesitation and felt his grip close on them. His fingers were cold, and I could see the hairs on his forearm ruffled with chill where he'd rolled up his sleeves to help Fanny with the gun.
"What hurts you cleaves my heart," he said softly. "You ken that, aye?"
"I do," I said just as softly. "And you know it's true for me, too. But..." I swallowed and bit my lip. It seems..."
"Claire,"
he interrupted, and looked at me straight.
"Are you relieved that he's dead?"
"Well, yes," I said unhappily. "I don't want to feel that way, though. It doesn't seem right. I mean..." I struggled to find some clear way to put it. "On the one hand, what he did to me wasn't mortal. I hated it. But it didn't physically hurt me. He wasn't trying to hurt me or kill me. He just..."
"You mean, if it had been Harley Bauble you met at Beardsley's, you wouldn't have minded my killing him in cold blood?" he interrupted with a tinge of irony.
"I would have shot him myself on sight." I blew out a long breath. "But that's the other thing. That's what he... the man. Do you know his name, by the way?"
"Yes. And you're not going to, so dinna ask me," he said tersely.
I gave him a narrow look, and he gave it right back. I flapped my hand, dismissing it for the moment. "The other thing," I repeated firmly, "is that if I'd shot Bauble myself, you wouldn't have had to. I wouldn't feel that you were damaged by it." His face went blank for a moment, then his gaze sharpened again.
"You think it damaged me to kill the man who took you?"
I reached for his hand and held it. "I bloody know it did," I said quietly, and added in a whisper, looking down at the scarred, powerful hand in mine, "What hurts you cleaves my heart, Jamie." His fingers curled tight over mine. He sat with his head bent for a long moment, then lifted my hand and kissed it gently.
"It's all right, Mokria," he said, "dinna fash. There's another side to it, and one that's nothing to do with you."
"What's that?" I asked, surprised. He squeezed my hand briefly and let it go, sitting back to look at me.
"I couldn't have let him live," he said simply, "whether he'd forced you or no. You were there when Ian asked me what to do. I said, kill them all. You heard me, aye?"
"I did." My throat was suddenly tight, and there was a band of iron around my chest, the taste of blood clotting my mouth and the fear of suffocation and blackness in my mind. The sense of that night seeped through me like cold smoke.
"I might have done that in a rage. I did do it in a black rage. But I would have done the same, was my blood as cold as ice."
He touched my face, smoothing back an escaped curl.
"Do you not see? Those men were brigands and worse. To leave one of them alive would be to leave the root of a poisonous plant in the ground to grow again."
It was a vivid image, but so was my memory of that large, shambling man wandering vaguely among the pig pens at Beardsley's trading post where I'd seen him afterward, seeming so unlike the man who'd come out of the darkness to smother me with the weight of his body. "But he seemed so feckless," I said with a helpless gesture. "How could someone like that even begin to assemble a gang?" He stood up suddenly, unable to sit any longer, and paced restlessly to and fro in front of me.
"Do you not see, Sassanach? Even if he was a feckless dolt, he went places. You saw him talk with the folk at Beardsley's, no?"
"Yes," I said slowly, but... He stopped, glaring down at me.
"And what if he began to talk one day about how he'd ridden wee Hodgepile and the Browns and the things they'd done? What if he lost himself in drink and boasted of how he'd..."
He choked that off and took a deep breath.
"About what he'd done to you."
I felt as though I'd swallowed something cold and slimy, and still faintly alive. Jamie's mouth compressed, looking at my face.
I'm sorry, Sassenach, he said quietly, but it's true. And I wouldn't have let that happen. Because of you, because of me. But more, because if it was known that such a thing had happened.
It was known, I said, my lips stiff. It is known. None of the men who had rescued me that night could have been in much doubt that I'd been raped, whether they knew which men had done the act or not. If they knew, their wives knew. No one had ever spoken to me of it, nor ever would, but the knowledge was there, and no way ever to make it go away.
Because if it was known that such a thing had happened, he repeated evenly, and that any man who took part in it had been allowed to live, then anyone who lives under my protection would feel themselves helpless. And rightly so.
He exhaled strongly through his nose, turning away.
Do you know, remember that man? The one who called himself Wendigo.
Jesus. Gooseflesh rippled over my shoulders and down my arms. I had forgotten. Not the man himself. He was a time traveller named Wendigo Donner, but his connection with the man we were discussing. A member of Hodgepyle's gang, Donner had escaped into the darkness when Jamie and his men had rescued me, and months later had come back to the ridge with companions to rob and kill in search of the gemstones he knew we had. It was his attack on the big house that had, indirectly, caused the conflagration that had burned it to the ground, and his ashes were still mingled with the remains of our lives in that clearing. Jamie was right. Donna had escaped and come back to try to kill us. To leave the Lupkin who'd raped me at large was to risk the same thing happening again. The realization of it sickened me. I'd managed to put most of what had happened aside, dealing with the physical aspects as necessary, firmly quashing or refusing to remember the rest. But it was still there, all of it, turning like an evil prism to show things in a harsh new light. The light, I now realized, that Jamie always saw by. And seeing now, clearly myself, I clenched my belly muscles and forced my voice to be steady.
What if he wasn't the last of them?
Jamie shook his head, not in negation, but resignation.
It doesn't matter, Sassenach. If there were others who escaped, most would be wise enough to leave and stay gone. But it doesn't matter. Another gang will spring up. It's the way of things, aye?
Is it? I thought he was right. I knew he was right, in terms of wars, governments, human foolishness in general. I just didn't want to believe it was true of this place. This was home. He nodded, watching my face, not without sympathy.
Remember Scotland? The Watch?
Yes. The Watches, he might have said, for there were many. Organized gangs who extorted money for protection, but sometimes gave that protection. And if they didn't get their money, black rent it was called, might burn your house, or crops, or do worse. I thought of the cabin Jamie and Roger had found, a burnt shell with the owners hanged from a tree before the house, and a young girl alive in the ashes so badly burnt that she couldn't live. We never discovered who had done it. Jamie could see the thoughts cross my face. I might as well have a neon sign on my forehead, I thought crossly. And evidently he saw that one too, for he smiled.
There's no law now, Sassenach, he said. Not with the government gone.
There was neither fear nor passion in that statement. It was merely the truth of the matter.
There never has been up here. None but you, I mean.
That made him laugh. But I was just as right as he was.
I didn't come to rescue you alone, I, that night?
No, I said slowly. You didn't. All the able-bodied men on the ridge had answered his call for help and come out to follow him, very much as his clansmen would have followed him to war had we been in Scotland. So, I said, taking a deep breath, those are the men you mean to, gang out with? He nodded, looking thoughtful.
Some of them, he said slowly, and then glanced at me. It's different now, Anian. There are men who were with me that night who will not follow me now, because they're king's men, Tories and loyalists. The men who've kent me longest didn't mind so much that I was a rebel general, but there are a good many new tenants who didn't ken me at all.
I'm not sure that rebel general is a title you can lose, I said.
No, he said, and smiled, though not with much humour. Not without turning my coot. I will.
He got to his feet and reached down a hand to pull me up in a rustle of leaves.
I've been a traitor for a long time, Sassenach, but I'd rather not be a traitor to both sides at once, if I can help it.
Shouts and barking rang out from the trail above. The children had reached Ian's house. We hurried after them and said no more of gangs, treason, or fat men in the dark.
Chapter 20. I bet you think this song is about you. No one went to the old garden, as the family called it. The people on the ridge called it the witch child's garden, though not often in my hearing. I wasn't sure whether witch child was meant to refer to Malva Christie herself or to her baby boy. Both of them had died in the garden in the midst of blood and in my company. She had been no more than 19. I never said the name aloud, but to me it was Malva's garden. For a time I hadn't been able to go up to it without a sense of waste and terrible sorrow, but I did go there now and then, to remember, to pray sometimes. And frankly, if some of the more hidebound Presbyterians of the Ridge had seen me on some of those occasions, talking aloud to the dead or to God, they would have been quite sure they had the right name, but the wrong witch. But the woods had their own slow magic, and the garden was returning to them, healing under grass and moss, blood turning to the crimson bloom of bee balm, and its sorrow fading into peace. Despite the creeping transformation, though, some remnants of the garden remained, and small treasures sprang up unexpectedly. There was a stubbornly thriving patch of onions in one corner, a thick growth of comfrey and sorrel fighting back against the grass, and, to my intense delight, several thriving peanut bushes sprung up from long-buried seeds. I'd found them 2 weeks before, the leaves just beginning to yellow, and dug them up. Hung them in the surgery to dry, plucked the dry peanuts from the tangle of dirt and rootlets, and roasted them in the shell, filling the house with memories of circuses and baseball games. And tonight, I thought, tipping the cooled nuts into my tin shelling basin, we'd have peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for supper. There was a breeze on the porch, and I was grateful for it on my face after the heat of sun and hearth. Also a little welcome solitude. Bree had gone with Roger to call upon the tenants I still thought of as the fisher folk, emigrants from Thurso, a dour lot of rock-ribbed Presbyterians who were deeply suspicious of Jamie as a Catholic, and much more of me. I was not only a Catholic but a conjure woman, and the combination unsettled them to no little degree. They did like Roger, though, in a grudging sort of way, and the liking seemed reciprocal. He understood them, he said. The children had done their chores and were scattered to the four winds. I heard their voices now and then giggling and shrieking in the woods behind the house, but God only knew what they were doing. I was just pleased that they weren't doing it right in front of me. Jamie was in his study, enjoying his own solitude. I'd passed by, carrying my big basin of peanuts outside, and seen him leaning back in his chair, spectacles on his nose, deeply absorbed in green eggs and ham. I smiled at the thought, and pulled off the ribbon to loosen my hair so the cool breeze could blow through it. We'd lost nearly all of our books in the fire that consumed the big house, but were beginning to build up our tiny library again. Brianna's contributions had nearly doubled it. Aside from the books she'd brought, and the thought of my precious Merck manual still gave me a small thrill of possession, we had Jamie's small green Bible, a Latin grammar,
The Complete Adventures of Robinson Crusoe, lacking a cover but retaining most of its vivid illustrations, and Jonathan Swift's Travels into Several Remote Nations of the World in Four Parts by Lemuel Gulliver, first a surgeon and then a captain of several ships, plus the odd novel in French or English. The shells cracked easily, but the dry skins of the peanuts inside were light and papery and clung to my fingers. I'd been brushing them off my skirt, which now looked as though I'd been attacked by a horde of pale brown moths. I wonder whether Bree might borrow something interesting to read while she was house-visiting with Roger. Hiram Crombie, the head man of the Thurso folk, was a reading man, though his taste ran to collections of sermons and historical accounts. He thought novels depraved. He did have a copy of The Aeneid, though. I'd seen it. Jamie had sent a letter to his friend Andrew Bell, an Edinburgh printer and publisher, asking him to send a selection of books, including copies of his own A Grandfather's Tales and my modest version of Do-It-Yourself Household Medicine, applying such monies as might have accrued to us in sales during the last 2 years toward the purchase of other books in the order. I wondered when and whether those might arrive. So far as I knew, the British still held Savannah, but Charlestown remained in American hands. If Mr. Bell was prompt about it, there was hope of a late ship showing up book-laden before the winter storms. Footsteps behind me interrupted my literary thoughts, and I turned to see Jamie, barefoot and rumpled, tucking his spectacles back into his sporran. "Enjoying your reading?" I asked, smiling.
"Aye."
He sat down beside me and picked a peanut out of the basin, cracked it, and tossed the nuts into his mouth.
"Brianna says Dr. Seuss made a good many books. Have you read them all, Sassenach?"
He pronounced it Seuss, incorrect German, and I laughed. "Oh, yes, many times. Bree had the whole set, or at least as many as were published then. I suppose she and Roger might have bought more for Jem and Mandy if Dr. Seuss, the Americans say his name Seuss, by the way, if he went on writing. I don't know how long he lived, will live," I corrected. "He was still at it in 1968. He nodded, a little wistful.
"I wish I could see them," he said. "But maybe Brianna will remember some of the rhymes at least."
"Ask Jem," I suggested. "Bree said he's read to Mandy since she was a baby, and he has an excellent memory." I laughed, thinking some of the Seuss illustrations. "Ask Bree if she can draw Horton the Elephant or Yertle the Turtle for you, from memory."
"Yertle?"
His face lighted with humour.
"That's no real name, is it?"
"No, but it rhymes with turtle." I cracked another nut and tossed the bits of shell into the grass.
"So does Myrtle," he pointed out.
"Yes, but Yertle is a boy. No female turtle would have done what he did." Jamie was diverted. He paused with his hand in the basin.
"What did he do?"
"Made all of the turtles in Salamassond build themselves into a tower so he could be king of all that he saw by sitting on top of them. It's an allegory about arrogance and pride. Not that females aren't capable of those emotions, just that they wouldn't do anything so easily illustrated." Jamie picked up a handful of peanuts and crushed them absent-mindedly, nodding.
"Aye.